From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith, filling in for Sylvia Maria Gross. This week, Kansas struggles to work out the kinks on a huge economic development project.
It could become the CDC, as Atlanta is for human health. Manhattan could be recognized for its major research in animal diseases.
As a major renewal project kicks off on Prospect, a local businessman remembers the street's golden years.
We had the Bukua business, everything you could think of.
And an MU anthropologist makes a major discovery in Peru.
The smaller mounds are being destroyed at a hideous rate. And I stopped one by refusing to get off the mound that a bulldozer was about to cut through.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news.
I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. With federal funding more at risk than ever for Manhattan's National Bio and Agro Defense Facility, Kansas Governor Brownback recently said the state could expect what he called a fight for the next 5 years. The state has promised more than $200 million in direct payments and in-kind supports for the lab, but already has spent almost a third of that on the site. In our continuing coverage, Tracking NBAF, Laura Ziegler lays out what Kansas has spent on the project and whether the tough economic environment puts the state's commitment at risk.
It has been more than 3 years since the Department of Homeland Security awarded the National Bio and Agri Defense Facility, or NBAF, to Manhattan, yet the animal disease lab still seems as foreign and exotic to many Kansans as the Nipah and Hendra viruses it will research.
InBev?
InBev?
Like the company that bought Budweiser or what?
That one?
It's called the National Bio and Agri Defense Facility.
No, I have not. I haven't heard of that.
I don't know. I'm afraid to ask anything. I don't know anything.
Kansas taxpayers Mike and Rico, who didn't want to give their last names, and David Ramirez, all recently spending a sunny weekend in the Argentine District in Kansas City, Kansas, will share in the benefits and the liabilities should that lab actually get built in the middle of the state.
Let's walk up this way, on the other side. Let's go behind this thing.
Tim Barr is the NBAF construction site manager, and he recently walked me around what is still a massive, muddy hole surrounded by piles of gravel. And it looks like it's going to stay that way, at least for now. Congress has put funding on hold until it sees what a committee from the National Academy of Sciences says about the lab's security. At the same time, it appears opposition to the project is growing. Kansans are already out of pocket for a bunch of NBAF-related costs. The state donated 48 acres to DHS, worth over $1 million, and authorized $105 million in revenue bonds for preparing the site. About a third of that has already been spent for specialized utilities.
Boilers, chillers for heating and cooling the facility, emergency diesel generators for emergency power.
I'm Lyle Butler, president and CEO of the Manhattan Area Chamber of Commerce.
And the city of Manhattan, Butler says, has thrown $5 million into the pot, enticed, he says, by the NBAF's economic development potential. A study commissioned by the Kansas State University estimated an economic impact on the state of some $2.5 billion, including more than 750 construction jobs and about 320 permanent workers. Butler says NBAF could change Manhattan forever.
It could become the CDC, as Atlanta is for human health. Manhattan could be recognized for its major research in animal diseases.
The university says some of that research is already happening here at the Biosecurity Research Institute in Pat Roberts Hall. It literally sits in the shadow of the NBAF construction site. The BRI cost Kansans about $58 million to build, and the state's invested many more millions to support NBAF-related research there. Those funds came through the Kansas Bioscience Authority, or KBA. It's a public-private partnership the state legislature created to bring bioscience industry to Kansas. Early on, NBAF was a priority for the KBA, says former board chair and former governor John Carlin.
Working closely with Homeland Security and USDA and the Kansas Congressional Delegation. Those were resources over a number of years that the authority put up to win the award.
But the KBA came under harsh scrutiny last year. Expense reports revealed what some state lawmakers felt was excessive spending, much of it related to lobbying for NBAF. The Johnson County District Attorney is currently reviewing a forensic audit to decide whether criminal charges are appropriate. Finally, the Kansas Department of Commerce committed $2 million early on to win the NBAF, low-interest loans for site development, and money for training a skilled workforce, $1,000 per each job created.
Signed pen, my wheat pen, but you're going to earn it, and you've already earned it. Thanks, Pat.
Last summer, Governor Sam Brownback gave Senator Pat Roberts, who's long carried the torch for the NBAF in Washington, the pen he used to sign an executive order creating a steering committee on NBAF. In explaining the need for the committee, the governor underscored the state's commitment to NBAF, but he said federal funding would be a struggle.
Now, this is going to be tough. The budget environment in Washington is extraordinarily challenging.
And that was before President Obama eliminated construction funds for the NBAF in the 2013 budget. Congressman Lynn Jenkins, whose second district includes the facility, said the White House was misguided in steering money away from national security. NBAF, she said, falls squarely within Washington's responsibility.
It's the right thing to do. It's a priority of the federal government, and we're going to get it done.
That's what Kansas is banking on, too. Manhattan won the NBAF largely because of a sweet package of incentives, including an offer to hand over the Biosecurity Research Institute lab to the Department of Homeland Security. DHS declined. Now, as NBAF is on hold and construction at that hole in Manhattan has slowed to a crawl, the state's investment also appears to be at risk. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Laura Ziegler.
During the past month, activists around Missouri have been gathering signatures for a ballot initiative to cap interest rates on payday loans at 36%. Currently, payday lenders in Missouri charge an average of 444% APR, about 30 times the average interest rate on credit cards. On Thursday, the petitioner's efforts were set back when a circuit court judge rejected the petition because pages of it did not contain the official ballot title. Instead, signers were given a summary written by Robin Carnahan's office. But the petitioners vowed to push forward with their effort. Just before the petition was thrown out, KBIA's Jacob Finston reported on the battle brewing between consumer advocates and the payday lending industry.
Hi, sir. Are you registered to vote in Missouri?
Hi, are you folks registered?
And ma'am, are you registered to vote in Missouri?
I already asked you.
You may have already signed it, a petition to cap the interest rates on payday loans in Missouri at 36%.
You'd like to cut interest rates on payday loans? They currently charge 440% interest. Are you registered in Boone County?
Yes, I am.
Great.
Missouri is fertile ground for payday lenders. With some of the loosest regulations in the nation, we're among the states with the most payday lending stores per capita. Now, the industry here is fighting for its life as activists aim for the November ballot to try to rein in these lenders they say trap the working poor in a cycle of debt. So just let me ask you to introduce yourself again. Tell me your name and who you are.
My name is Finney Marie Dorsey.
And when you first took out a loan, you said it was like for...
It was for social enjoyment. I wanted to play bingo. I just thought I was just going to take this loan, go play some bingo. Honestly, I thought I was going to take this loan, go play some bingo and win. But I lost.
So 2 weeks later, she renewed the loan, adding another $15 or so in interest to the original $100 loan. Soon, she was taking out loans to pay for other expenses, loans to pay the interest on earlier loans.
I had more loans than anybody would ever believe. I mean, it wasn't like loans in Columbia, loans in Fulton. I mean, I just had them everywhere. I mean, I just thought like, okay, every time I had a financial problem, I always say to myself, oh, I'll go get a loan tomorrow. And it's just spun out of control.
I was an undergrad. I needed a job.
While Dorsey was busy taking out loans all over Missouri, Graham McCauley was working at a payday loan shop in Columbia. He says part of his job was getting people to renew loans week after week. In fact, he says this was the business model.
So we would get calls twice a day from our corporate person, and we would have to call in the numbers each night. And I thought that the numbers that would look great is the percentage of people who came in and paid off their loans or how well we're doing. But the main percentage they cared about was this buyback percent. And that was the percent of people who either renewed their loan or immediately took it back out.
One national study found the average payday borrower taking out a $325 loan will renew it 8 times, eventually paying more than $400 in interest. In other words, borrowing $300 and paying back $800. Now, McCauley and Dorsey work with grassroots organizing. It's one of the advocacy groups trying to cap payday loans at 36%.
If it was at 36%, you couldn't stay in business at all.
Don Wells is a Republican state representative, and he's chairman of the Missouri House Banking Committee. He also owned a payday lending store until just a few years ago.
When you do the arithmetic, you'll see that the profits aren't there that everyone thinks people are making. And that's one reason I sold my business.
So from an economic standpoint, that's a pretty easy decision. It matches what's called a shutdown condition.
Joseph Haslig, an economist at the University of Missouri.
Businesses go out when they can't afford to continue operating.
Haslig was hired by payday supporters to analyze the effect a 36% cap would have on the payday and title loan industry in Missouri. He found it would cause all of those businesses to shut their doors, a $78 million blow to the state GDP. Haslig's analysis was adopted by the state auditor as part of the official ballot summary. But supporters of the rate cap say the industry does far more harm than good.
They're making money off poor and desperate people. It's usury, plain and simple.
Representative Mary Still, a Democrat from Columbia. Every year she's been in the General Assembly, she's introduced a bill to cap payday loans. This year, Still's trying a different route, supporting the ballot initiative. She's pretty much given up on getting her legislation through the House. One reason is Banking Committee Chairman Don Wells.
I told my committee that we're not going to hear junk that just consumes your time and has no benefit for your constituent or the state. And so I have decided not to hear her bill.
In fact, Still's legislation hasn't been referred to any committee, and it probably won't be. It's languishing on the desk of the Speaker of the House, Republican Stephen Tilley.
Would you support her bill?
Nope. I mean, because it has the cap on, and I'm not a big fan of telling small businesses what they can and can't charge.
And proponents of the rate cap say that money from the industry is influencing the legislature. And I looked at, I think you've gotten about $70,000 from the industry over the past, since 2006. Do you think that money plays a role in this, in the legislature?
Not at all. I've got a long record of not telling small businesses what they should do, and I had that record before I got here.
Tilley calls payday lenders small businesses. But the biggest one in the state, Quick Cash, reported $123 million in revenue last year. Nearly one quarter of that came from its 100 stores in Missouri.
The payday loan industry, the short-term loan industry in Missouri, believes the status quo does a great job of protecting consumers.
Eric Banks is the spokesperson for a campaign committee called Missourians for Equal Credit Opportunity. The group has raised $1.1 million so far to fight the ballot initiative. His side has almost 10 times as much cash as the other side. So I asked him where that money's coming from.
That's not an important issue. The important issue is, should we not continue to have opportunities for people to get credit on an emergency short-term basis?
So I rephrased the question.
You've raised $1,100,000.
I said, you're spending all this money to influence voters, and you don't think they have a right to know where the money's coming from? And his answer again.
No, the public has no more right to know exactly where the money is coming from, nor to know where the money is being spent.
Actually, under Missouri law, campaigns do have to disclose who's funding them. It's public information. But campaign reports filed by Missourians for Equal Credit Opportunity show every cent comes from one group, a nonprofit that doesn't have to disclose its funding, thereby concealing the ultimate source. While Missourians for Equal Credit Opportunity is fighting to defeat the 36% cap, it's supporting two other initiatives with strikingly similar language, but that would have no effect on the industry. Activists say it's a tactic to confuse voters.
Are you all registered voters?
I found these two women gathering signatures recently in Columbia. I started chatting with them without telling them I was a reporter right away.
What are you getting signatures for?
It's to allow voters to be able to decide whether or not they want a cap put on payday loans. It's an initiative to get on the ballot so we can vote on it.
What's the payday loan cap?
It's right now it's at 41, they want to put it at 36.
She made it sound like I'd be signing up for capping interest rates on payday loans,
but the petition she showed me would instead amend the state constitution banning any such interest rate cap. Finally, I told them I was a reporter, and I asked who they were working for.
We are not really supposed to talk to reporters.
So far, 17 states have capped payday loans. Most recently, in 2010, Montana and Arizona voted by wide margins for a 36% cap. That's why the payday lending industry wants to make sure this doesn't get on the ballot here. In its most recent annual report, QuickCash, the largest payday lender in Missouri, noted that ballot initiatives are, quote, expensive to oppose and more susceptible to emotion than deliberations in the normal legislative process. I'm Jacob Fenston.
Coming up, an MU professor makes discoveries that will change the way we think about ancient South America. This is Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. Sylvia is away this week. One veteran business person at Long Prospect took a very personal interest this week as a celebration took place of a multi-million-dollar community development project along his blighted strip of the boulevard. Kenneth W. Bledsoe went to work with his father right out of Central High School at Bledsoe's Rental Company at 50th and Prospect. Founded in 1945, there are now other Bledsoes around the city, thanks to startup property and inventory provided by Mr. Bledsoe. Managers eventually bought the spinoff businesses from Bledsoe, no franchise fees or reimbursement required.
Bledsoe's 50-year-old son was murdered during a daytime robbery at the store last spring, but that only heightens his optimism about the corridor's potential turnaround. This week, the Blue Hills Community Services Center kicked off a $3.1 million community center project just down the street from Bledsoe, one of several new projects along Prospect.
Susan recently sat down with Mr. Bledsoe to talk about his business and what Prospect Corridor was like decades ago.
It was really good. We had the streetcars running around the street. Now we had good transportation then. It only costs a nickel. And we had lots of people around here. We got to one point where the people all took care of the property and everything, and we rented as many as 30 mowers at one time to cut their grass around here. Now you can't rent one because they let it go up and they don't take care of it. I don't have the pride in keeping their things up like they used to.
And I understand business was booming around here, and there were a lot of businesses on this street around you.
We had the buku of business, everything you could think of. Good restaurants. We had a few bars. We had bowling alleys. We had shows. We had sheet metal people, a drugstore in the corner that made malts for my dad every night, chocolate malts. He loved them. Every night he got a chocolate malt.
What were some of your favorite restaurants back then?
Brownies was a favorite right across the street. And then Piper's was up the street about 59th, and that they had special on fried chicken a certain day, and you couldn't even get in. It's still there, but it's just a little hole in the wall, but they had great fried chicken.
So when did you first notice the first signs of change on Prospect?
Oh, it was probably in the last 15 years, it started going down. Whenever they took the highway out here to make this freeway, well, they went and condemned all the property and made all the people move out. And then they never did build a highway for 40 years after that, and it sort of became stagnant. In other words, there was not enough people there to support them.
So now you mentioned the highway and the impact it had. What were the other factors that made Prospect go down as it did?
Well, I imagine probably the recession did, and then the houses started. They didn't keep the houses up, so they went down. They didn't have enough people to come back in there, so they went backwards.
This is difficult to talk about, but last May, your son David was killed in a robbery, and I want to offer my sincere condolences. That had to be a devastating blow to you and your family. How are you not angry or bitter or you know, that sort of thing after something like that happens?
Well, it's one of those things that I just don't know what causes it, why anybody would want to do it. Actually, it was one of our customers that brought his grandkids over here to do that, and I just don't understand that because we always treated them right. They wanted money, and I think it was probably because they had to have drugs, etc., because there's a lot of drugs around this area right now.
And so you're still here in spite of all of that, shortened hours, right?
We went to work at 7 in the morning and didn't get off till 8 o'clock at night and worked in 9 to 5 on Sundays. We had to cut our hours back 9 to 1 because we didn't have enough help to run it. And it's hard to find somebody like David. David did most of the mechanical work.
But people are still renting things, right?
Oh, yeah, they're still renting. And if they don't rent it, they ask us where they can get it, and we refer them to the next rental store, which is the closest.
This week there was a kickoff event to announce the new investments in Prospect. Now, does this give you hope, or are you still kind of skeptical since there are other projects in the blighted areas around Kansas City that seem to start up and then they sputter?
Well, I think this one here has got a lot better chance because they've already got the money in advance, and they've got the plan set up, and if they get the first thing going, I think it'll expand to other plans, which would be to take the neighborhoods and tear them down or rehab them and bring back some of the people that moved out will come back. And if they do that, then our business will start coming back. But it's going to be a slow process, of course, just like the recession. It ain't over today. It takes a while.
What would you personally like to see happen on Prospect?
Well, I'd like to see a lot of businesses start coming back, you know. So if you got businesses there, then people will come to them, and that'll make more people come back. They'll need housing. They need to tear down the junkers and the things and put new housing in. And, you know, where people can have yards and they enjoy themselves more. Of course, the first place thing they're going to have to do is sort of get rid of the drugs in the area.
So as this Prospect renovation happens, what are your plans for the business?
Well, we're trying to turn it around, but when they had the accident, they said everybody told us that it was closed on television and stuff, so everybody thought we was closed down, and we lost about 50% of our business, so it's pretty bad. But I figured eventually it should turn around and come back. We're just hoping for the best. Just like the country's hoping for the best. There's no sure thing.
Well, Mr. Bledsoe, I really appreciate you taking the time to be on KC Currents.
Thank you, too, for coming out and seeing us.
If you can't listen to all of KC Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got podcasts. Find us on iTunes. These days, you can use the internet to do some pretty amazing stuff. You can watch just about any movie or read any book anytime you want. You can video chat with someone on the other side of the world. Or, if you are retired MU professor Robert Benfer, you can discover the massive structures left behind by an ancient Peruvian civilization using Google Earth. Alex Smith has the story.
Anthropologist Robert Benfer received international recognition in 2006. That's when he announced the discovery of an ancient observatory in Buena Vista, Peru, that was built to mark the winter and summer solstices. The structure was 4,200 years old, older than Stonehenge. Its sophistication forced scientists and historians to reevaluate the ancient people of Peru. Binfer has spent much of the past few years following up on that discovery and continuing to explore the area. In 2010, he made another major discovery in Peru, but this one happened while he was in the U.S.
Wisconsin had over 10,000 animal effigy mounds in the 18th and 19th centuries. They're nearly all gone now, but a lot of them have been reserved in parks, and I visited them. So I had at the back of my mind this image, and I knew that they didn't exist anywhere else in the world, not in Europe, not in Asia, not in Africa, not in South America, only in the central part of the United States, perhaps because I had that image in the back of my mind. And then I noticed through Google Earth imagery this one, particularly a condor, which I'd always been suspicious of from our maps.
The condor mound, like the animal effigy mounds in Wisconsin and Ohio, is a huge animal shape built from earth. These are so big that the animal shape is only discernible from a high vantage point. After spotting the condor, Binfer also noticed another animal. It's a monster, somewhere between a puma and a crocodile-like animal called a caiman. Binfer suspected he was onto something big, so he decided to travel to a coastal valley north of Lima to confirm his findings.
When I got there and I realized, yeah, these are animals, but, oh, wait a minute, maybe they're only two, but they can't be only two. And so I started going up the valleys one by one north of this valley, and I found them in every valley. I've done six so far. So they were common.
The mounds Binfer found range from 5 to 400 meters long, and he suspects they were built by carrying dirt and rocks in baskets. By examining the sophistication of nearby ceramic fragments, or the lack of fragments, Binfer estimates that some of the mounds could be as many as 5,000 years old. That's way before the Inca Empire, which lasted from the mid-1400s to the mid-1500s AD. And they also predate the North American mounds by a few thousand years. There's still a lot to learn about the Peruvian mounds, but Binfer has already published an early account of his discovery in Antiquity Journal. He says the need for people to know about these mounds is urgent.
Because the smaller mounds are being destroyed at a hideous rate. I mean, I personally, in these 2 years, I have seen about 8 of them disappear. And I stopped one by refusing to get off the mound that a bulldozer was about to cut through. Until he finally went and got the supervisor, and he said, well, you know, I don't know if he did it after we left or not, but he said he wouldn't. We'll see. Well, I'm going to go back. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I want some publicity there. The farmers, if they knew these were important mounds, they might not destroy them. They don't know. They know they're archaeological mounds, of course. They know everything about their fields, but they think they're unimportant because some of the smaller ones they just don't seem important to them.
One of the closest things, as we talked about, to these mounds that people are already sort of familiar with are the mounds in North America.
Yes. Right?
How do these compare with those in terms of, you know, scale and sophistication?
Well, they're on the same level. The two largest ones are 400 meters long. There are a few in Ohio that are larger than that. But generally speaking, they're about on the same scale. Mm-hmm. And actually, none of the ones in North America are as large in volume as some of the ones that I have found. They just weren't built that tall. But the one, for example, the Serpent Mounds and all those, I've walked across similar ones in Wisconsin. They're just 5, 6, 8 feet tall at most in the center. But at some of these are 40 feet tall. On top of one is a platform mound with stairs and then with big stones on each side. There's nothing like that in North America.
The mounds in Peru, they are designed to sort of mirror astrological signs.
That's my working hypothesis. It's the same hypothesis for the mounds in North America.
Mm-hmm. And are they lined up with stars that you would see in South America?
Well, here's the way they're lined up. The ones at El Paraiso, which is where I began, are lined up with the extreme that the Milky Way can form in any 24-hour period. And I have to make a little digression here as to why that would be. If you're close to the equator, you don't see Polaris, and actually Polaris wasn't anywhere near the north at that time anyhow. And there's nothing in the south. There's almost no stars in the south because you're looking away from the galaxy. So cardinal directions don't loom as large. You can create them
by what's called a gnomon, a stick in the ground. You can learn which way north is by the shadows of the sun. But mostly people oriented themselves more by the extremes that the Milky Way could form.
Why did they build the mounds, you know, lined up with the stars like this?
I don't know the answer. But here's the thing about the Andean peoples and really South American peoples. They were like modern physicists. They did not see time and space as orthogonal, that is, as independent. They considered them the same thing. And so when they talk about time and space, they talk about it in a different way than you and I do, but not in a different way than a physicist was. And so they were very concerned in keeping track, shall we say, of where they were. Part of the general concept of locating ourselves, the human need to locate ourselves in time and space, is that we have some axes that are important to us. And for them, there were several for time and space. The solstices were very important because in the coastal valleys, the December 21st solstice announced that the river was going to begin to rise from the melting of the glaciers. It also told you that if you went down to the coast, if all the birds were still there, then there was not going to be an El Nino year. El Nino years were terrible for fishermen, but they were disasters for farmers because you only get droughts or floods. And in fact, you don't have a very good chance of surviving just with farming in an El Nino year. So December 21st solstice is very important. So that sunrise is one that people attended to. And the March 21st equinox, equally important. Because on that day, if you haven't gotten the crop in, you're done for because the water is going to begin to reside. So these early farmers, every day they saw where the sun set, and nobody would be so stupid that they wouldn't notice this connection.
The only ancient structures in South America that come close to the mounds are the Nazca lines, which are also located in Peru. The lines are also giant animal shapes, some as big as 200 meters, which were carved out on plateaus about 1,500 years ago. Because these shapes are also only recognizable from a high vantage point, some people have wondered if they were designed to communicate with extraterrestrials, and it's likely that similar theories will build up around the mounds. Benford doesn't completely dismiss the idea, but he's pretty skeptical.
I didn't have any opinion on extraterrestrials because if they were here, they didn't. They came with a light touch, but I think you know that's fantasy, and I'm a scientist. I don't have any opinion on that. But we know a lot about how Andeans communicate with the non-material world. Because people still do today, and we know from ethnohistorical accounts what they did, and we know from archaeological cases what was going on, and here's the way it went. Priests made offerings to the earth, because if you're going to do farming, you're going to cut into the earth, and that's harming the earth, and you're going to have to make offerings for her to forgive you and give you a good crop. But the thing that was looking down on you was not gods up in the heaven, but spirits in the tallest mountains, which are called Apus, A-P-U. And the condor would communicate with them how things were going on the ground and, you know, were the offerings being made properly. And if they were not, the Apus could do bad things. They could bring lightning to kill you. There sure was, a continent-wide a set of beliefs about how humans interact with the supernatural world, and none of that implies any visitor from another universe. Mm-hmm. Such a thing might happen. Perhaps such a thing has happened, but if it has, it was outside the realm of science, and nothing was left behind to suggest that.
MU Professor Emeritus Robert Benfer says his next step is returning to Peru so he can radiocarbon date the mounds. For Casey Currents, this is Alex Smith.
Hey! Hey! Hey!
After the break, the Nelson Atkins Museum revisits the great world's fairs. This is Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. In area news this week, a judge said the Catholic diocese and its bishop can go on trial. A school district had to wait for results of its board election, and the postseason finally ended for KU. Steve Bell revisits those and other top stories of the week on KCUR's Weekend News Review.
Disappointed? Yes. But fans had no hard feelings over KU's 67-59 loss to Kentucky in the NCAA Men's Championship game in New Orleans. After all, this was the team that at the beginning of the season was never expected to even come close to the Final Four. Coach Bill Self's comment?
You know, we came up short, but you know, I don't think we lost. I think they just beat us, and I'm really proud of our team.
Meanwhile, freshly fired Bruce Weber, who was Self's replacement at Illinois, signed on to fill the vacancy at K-State, left by the departure of head coach Frank Martin. The Kansas City School Board gave interim superintendent Dr. Steve Green a 4-year contract Monday, just in time for the school board election. That was still up in the air at week's end because all candidates in all races but one were write-ins. And as Kansas City Star reporter Joe Robertson explained,
the election board is saying that they've never had this situation where you have a predominantly write-in votes. And I think that includes, you know, the at-large race for Eric Leonard West's seat that, you know, they're counting votes from across the whole school district for that one. So it'll be interesting how long that'll take.
In the one race with candidates on the printed ballot, challenger John Heil defeated incumbent Arthur Benson. The Kansas City City Council voted not to send the voters an initiative that would forbid future city involvement in plants that make nuclear weapons parts. John Sharp spoke for the council majority.
We have no obligation to try to clean up an initiative petition that is flawed, that is unconstitutional, that can't be enforced.
Committees had tried twice to rewrite the initiative so it would be legal, but decided in the end that any rewrite should come from the group that circulated the petitions. Peace Planters says they'll rewrite and collect signatures again. After a hearing last week, the lawyer for the Catholic Diocese and Bishop Robert Finn told Dan Verbeck,
I always think our side is stronger than the other.
But he was overly optimistic. When the ruling came this week, Judge John Torrance said the law on reporting suspected child sex abuse is not vague, and prosecutors can bring the diocese and the bishop to trial for failure to report it. Environmentalists threatened the Kansas City, Kansas Board of Public Utilities with a lawsuit over two coal-fired KCK power plants. Scott Allegrucci of the Sierra Club said the pollution control equipment at the two plants has been outdated for years.
Given the duration of the legal violations and the concern of citizens in the community, Sierra Club thought it was time to call KCBP on it.
The Sierra Club warned the BPU, order it cleaned up within 60 days or we sue. The Missouri Senate made progress on the budget, with leaders predicting they won't cut funding for higher education or an assistance program for the blind. Denny Huff of the Missouri Association for the Blind hopes they're right about that.
2,800 blind people in Missouri without medical coverage. Some of them may have some medical coverage, but some of them will not have any if this passes.
The Appropriations Committee says the blind program is likely to be spared at the expense of cuts to other social services. The Kansas legislature's failure to produce a budget before they went on spring break caused the state's chief justice to announce this week that system employees will be furloughed every other Friday starting April 13th. This is KCUR.
Analysts have known for years that Kansas has a severe shortage of dentists, and that shortage is getting worse. The problem is greatest in rural Kansas, especially in the western part of the state. An idea under consideration is the creation of a mid-level dental provider. This would be a person whose training and skills fall somewhere between those of a hygienist and a full-fledged dentist. But the proposal to create such a position remains bogged down in the Kansas legislature. KPR's Brian Thompson reports.
You don't have to be in poverty or even uninsured to run into trouble trying to access dental care in western Kansas. Just ask Fort Hays State University President Ed Hammond.
I can't get dental services where they accept our Delta Dental Blue Cross Blue Shield plan. As a state employee, I get and pay for dental insurance, but the dentists in western Kansas don't accept it.
Hammond says he's had to switch dentists 3 times to find someone who would accept his dental insurance. There are 13 primary care dentists in the Hays area, but Hammond says only 2 or 3 accept Delta Dental.
The shortage is impacting not just the indigent, not just the children. It's impacting all of Kansans and western part of the state.
A report published last fall by the Kansas Department of Health and Environment and the University of Kansas Medical Center counted 1,159 primary care dentists in the 105 counties of Kansas. However, roughly half of them are located in metropolitan Kansas City and Wichita. Add in Topeka and Lawrence, and more than 700 of the state's dentists are in just 4 communities. Most counties in the western half of the state have only 1 or 2 dentists, if any. A dozen counties, plus 3 more in eastern Kansas, have no dentist at all. Hammond says it's not hard to understand why dentists are reluctant to set up shop in frontier counties.
The problem is the people graduating from dental school are coming out with tremendous debt. And then they have to get a lot of equipment. Their practice has to generate a certain amount of resources in order for it to make sense. And so, therefore, they don't go to western Kansas in the smaller towns.
Hammond thinks the solution is to create a so-called mid-level dental provider, comparable to the mid-level providers who are already helping meet the need for medical care in rural Kansas.
We train nurse practitioners that go out to various different communities throughout the state and provide medical services. We're proposing to do the same thing with the mid-level professional in the area of dentistry.
Hammond says Fort Hays State University is prepared to begin training this new class of dental providers as soon as the legislature approves the proposal. That may be a while. A coalition called the Kansas Dental Project submitted a plan last year. It would create a new type of provider with more training than a dental hygienist, but not as much as a dentist, called a Registered Dental Practitioner, or RDP. But the Kansas Dental Association has fought this idea all the way. Kevin Robertson heads the association.
The overwhelming majority of dentists are opposed to the registered practitioner model. And it's not like 99%, it's 99.9%.
Robertson says the proposal goes too far by allowing RDPs to perform procedures which are, by definition, considered surgery.
Anything that includes the cutting of the hard surfaces of the tooth is considered surgery. The bill is written to allow the extraction of all primary teeth, or meaning baby teeth. Now, a lot of listeners might think, well, baby teeth, well, I've pulled out my son or my daughter's baby teeth. Well, there's nothing in the proposal that says it has to already be loose.
And Robertson says what sounds like a simple procedure can suddenly become more than a registered dental practitioner is trained or licensed to do.
Maybe you've snapped off a tooth. Maybe the roots wrapped around the nerve and you didn't know it at the time. So those are the types of things that could occur that we're concerned about.
Robertson predicts that mid-level providers would actually make it more difficult for dentists to make ends meet in rural areas. He says that would create a 2-tiered system of dental care in Kansas. Dentists for those in the more populated areas, and mid-level providers with a lower level of training for rural Kansans.
I would describe no care as second-class care, and that's the system we have in place now for many Kansans.
That's Shannon Katsaratis. She heads the advocacy group Kansas Action for Children, which is spearheading the Kansas Dental Project, the effort to create licensed mid-level dental providers.
Our goal is to make sure that all Kansans, regardless of what kind of insurance they may have or whether or not they have insurance at all, can access care. And we believe adding another member to the Kansas dental team will help ensure that.
Katsaratis says the opposition to registered dental practitioners is based on fear and misinformation.
The research says very clearly that mid-level dental providers can provide the same quality and the same level of safety in the care they deliver as a dentist within their scope of practice. And I would challenge the Kansas Dental Association to produce research that demonstrates something to the contrary.
Hays dentist Melinda Miner sees a lot of patients whom she believes could benefit from the services of a registered dental practitioner. One of the so-called dental deserts identified in the KDHE Dental Workforce Report is just to the south and west of Hays. It's an area of approximately 500 square miles where there are no primary care dentists at all. Miner envisions being able to use registered dental practitioners to bring dental care to nearby Trigo and Ness counties, which currently have no dentists.
Our goal would be to open outreach clinics in the surrounding communities for preventive, for cleanings, for checkups, for small fillings.
Miner says people will drive long distances for major dental problems, but they're less likely to do so for the kind of routine care that can prevent more serious issues.
You know, having to take your child out of school, take half a day off work, drive 30 minutes or more to go to the dentist for a routine checkup or preventive care is a lot less likely to happen than if you have a preventive person in your town.
The proposed law would require registered dental practitioners to spend their first 500 hours of practice under the direct supervision of a licensed dentist. That means they'd start out in the Hayes Clinic just down the hall from Miner and her husband. Once they're placed in the outreach clinics, they'd be under what's called general supervision. Miner says telemedicine makes it possible to supervise their work without being at the same location.
All of our x-rays are on the computer. They can send us a photograph or an x-ray and ask us our opinion. You don't have to be there in person to watch over somebody.
Miner sees mid-level providers not as a threat to her practice, but as a way to make it more efficient and expand her patient base.
Every dentist can run their practice how they want to, and I don't want to tell a dentist, hey, you have to take Medicaid, or you have to see people for free, or you have to use a hygienist. There's dentists that don't want to use a hygienist. That's fine for their practice. But I would prefer if they don't tell me I can't do something that would help my practice to be better.
The Kansas Dental Association does support expanding the role of dental hygienists. They've endorsed a bill to create what's called an Extended Care Permit 3. It would allow specially trained hygienists, under the sponsorship of a dentist, to provide temporary fillings, adjust dentures, and remove very loose baby teeth. Their services would be aimed at underserved children, senior citizens, and people in various forms of state care or custody. Those favoring creation of registered dental practitioners say this bill would help, but it doesn't go nearly far enough. The level of unmet dental need is clear to anyone who's ever attended a Kansas Mission of Mercy event. The Kansas Dental Charitable Foundation held its 11th free dental clinic in Kansas City, Kansas last February. As volunteers and patients filled a former Walmart store, organizer Greg Hill described the turnout.
At 8 p.m. last night, there were about 100 of them in line. When we opened the doors, they spent the night indoors, and by 5:30, there were 1,200 people in the building.
That's when the parking lot had to be closed, because that's all the patients that could be treated in a single day, even with 165 volunteer dentists and many more hygienists and other support staff from all across the state. Kansas is among 15 states where advocates are working to expand the dental workforce with mid-level dental providers. So far, Alaska and Minnesota are the only states where these providers have been authorized. For the Kansas Public Radio Network, I'm Brian Thompson.
The first World's Fair was held in London in 1851, and it's a tradition that continues today. There's one coming up next month in South Korea. A new exhibition at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art highlights the importance and influence of innovation at the World's Fairs. KCUR Laura Spencer reports.
What do you think of when you hear the words World's Fair? Maybe it's the Eiffel Tower from the 1889 fair in Paris, the Ferris wheel from the 1893 Chicago fair, or songs like Meet Me in St. Louis from the film starring Judy Garland, set the year before the 1904 World's Fair in St. Louis.
If you will meet me in St. Louis, meet me at the fair.
It's often the architectural marvels that are remembered, but most were built as temporary structures. Thousands of pieces of decorative art, crafted from ceramics, metal, glass, silver, porcelain, or wood, still remain, snapped up at World's Fairs by collectors or museums.
So this is where people will first come in, and there'll be a big graphics outside.
Catherine Footer is the decorative arts curator at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. She says World's Fairs first captured her imagination as a young child.
I grew up in New York City, so I went to the 1964 at least a couple of times. I don't have too much of a memory, although I have my Sinclair dinosaur from that fair. And then in 1967, my mother took us up to, my sister and me, to Montreal to see Expo 67. So I've always had this love of them.
When she was in graduate school at Yale, Footer says she started thinking about the architecture of World's Fairs. And later, as associate curator at the Minneapolis Institute of Arts, she studied World's Fair acquisitions that she described as the epitome of style and craftsmanship. An idea for an exhibition has been percolating for years.
And I've taken it from museum to museum, and fortunately it landed here, and now it's the culmination of my vision. And I have to tell you that it is exceeding all my expectations.
Footer worked with Jason Bush of the Carnegie Museum of Art in Pittsburgh to choose the 200 objects in the exhibition, settling on the themes of innovation in technology and materials. They traveled the globe, acquiring loans from all over Europe and the United States, and works for the collection of the Nelson Atkins. There's an immense Gothic Revival bookcase, a delicate Tiffany brooch with champagne diamonds, an Art Deco glass chair.
Every object in the exhibition had to fight for its place because we saw tens of thousands of objects on our search for the ones that should be in the exhibition.
The exhibition spans the first World's Fair in London in 1851 to the 1939 fairs in New York and San Francisco. The fairs promoted innovation, competition, and consumerism. But Footer says they also led to a cross-cultural dialogue as the first global meeting places. She points to a pair of Japanese vases with samurai fighting under cherry blossoms from the Philadelphia 1876 centennial.
Its form is Japanese, its subject matter is Japanese, and yet it starts to become very European very quickly because the composition, the sort of asymmetry in this cartouche and the sort of busyness was actually catering to European taste. So it's Japanese looking at Europeans who had been looking at Japanese things.
There are moments in the exhibition where you might experience the energy of a World's Fair, a vintage loop of film footage, stereoscopes and viewmasters with vivid 3D images, a display where you can virtually try on jewelry in the exhibition. As you walk through the galleries, the colors of the walls and the casework change, from classical to a bit of a flourish to streamlined and modern.
What I hope is as they move through, they start feeling a lightness with the Art Nouveau, nature, colors start changing, the objects, of course, change. And then when they come into the last section, they're going to see things that really relate to their own lives. Some of the objects that are in this last section are still in production today, such as the Barcelona chair and the Alto Savoy vase. Both of those are still made today, but they also relate visually to what we live with today.
Another element that connects viewers to today is outside, the temporary structure the museum commissioned called the Sun Pavilion. Front and center on the Nelson's lawn, it's made of shipping containers and a canopy of solar panels.
The design community here is so creative, and we're very hopeful that this might turn into a project that can be repeated, that it doesn't need a World's Fair exhibition to have that kind of excitement.
The exhibition took years of planning and months of installation work, and Footer says the team of about 100 designers, curators, handlers, and staffers at the museum has been as innovative as if they were putting on their own World's Fair. Laura Spencer, KCUR News.
The exhibition, Inventing the Modern World, Decorative Arts at World Fairs, 1851 to 1839, opens April 14th and runs through August 19th at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. We thank you for tuning into KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast. Find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Sylvia Maria Gross. Alex Smith is the assistant producer, and Kayla Regan and Carrie Coogan are our interns. We had extra help from Laura Ziegler. Our theme music is by Approach, and I'm Susan Wilson.
I'm Alex Smith. Sylvia will be back next week.